and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump's Oval Office speech last night calling for $5 billion to construct a wall along the border with Mexico apparently did nothing to bring politicians on Capitol Hill any closer together. Meanwhile, with no end in sight to the government shutdown, Republicans in both the House and the Senate are beginning to break away from the president. Next, teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School District are set to go on strike tomorrow after years of frustration over class sizes, salaries, and a shortage of nurses and school counselors. The district has made several offers, but the teachers' union says they don't go far enough. So barring a last-minute deal, 32,000 teachers will walk off the job tomorrow. Then, newly declassified information suggests that CIA Director Gina Haspel was in charge of a secret CIA facility at Guantanamo Bay, a site notorious around the world for torture of detainees. If true, the revelation shows a much deeper involvement in CIA torture than Haspel has so far admitted to. And then, attorneys for former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort made a critical error yesterday when they filed motions in federal court and accidentally revealed that Manafort had met in 2016 with Konstantin Kilimnik and passed him polling data. But once again, crucial details are being left out of the mainstream media narrative. And finally, states and localities across the country are expanding health care access to their residents, despite the fact that Republicans at the federal level are still seeking to weaken or to do away with the Affordable Care Act. Single-payer health care is widely popular, but what is the best way to go about achieving it? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the government shutdown. President Trump's Oval Office speech last night calling for $5 billion to construct a wall along the border with Mexico apparently did nothing to bring politicians on Capitol Hill any closer together. He will meet with Republicans on the Hill today. Meanwhile, with no end of the government shutdown in sight, Republicans in both the House and the Senate are beginning to break away from the president. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to the London Review of Books, The Nation, Extra, Tarbell, and Salon.com. Welcome back, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Dave, this morning, a couple of Republicans peeled off. Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Susan Collins from Maine, Will Hurd from Texas in the House of Representatives. The president's beginning to lose Republicans. They see the writing on the wall. They see the polls. The polls are saying that the vast majority of Americans blame the president for this shutdown. And the Democratic message that there is no crisis, very simply, seems to have legs. Is that how you see things?
Yeah, I had predicted that. I mean, it's really a combination of two things. One is that there is no crisis, that the immigration is way, way down. Illegal immigration is way, way down. Immigration overall is way, way down. And this is all a complete fantasy about terrorists and, you know, drugs coming through the border. Neither comes through the border. Drugs come through regular ports of entry, hidden in containers and so on. The amount of drugs that come, you know, through the wire and over the river and stuff is minuscule. And the other thing is that the pain of the government shutdown is largely hitting ordinary people who, many of whom are Republicans. And I looked at a map of the states that are impacted the most, and they seem to be like Montana and Idaho and Texas and a whole swath of states that are heavily Republican.
Dave, what did you make of the Democratic response? I was struck not by the message, but by the appearance of two mannequins whose lower jaws were moving.
They look like stuffed animals.
They did. Plastic people.
Yeah, okay, plastic. I think that's better than stuffed animals.
Pelosi may be stuffed. I mean, she's really up there, but in age. And Schumer is a pretty uninspiring speaker. I mean, they could have come up with more feisty responders. I mean, Trump was pretty canned too.
Yeah.
They all seemed like wind-up toys. He was adhering to pretty tightly to a script. You know, he always has his little add-on sentences that he throws in, you know, like still the greatest army, you know, in the world and blah, 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 you know, that he'll throw in his little asides. But, you know, he was pretty well following the teleprompter.
I just have to say, I watched it last night. I thought it was mercifully brief. So that was like, I was like, oh my God, it's only 8 minutes. That's great. And then these two, I don't know, they really look like stuffed animals to me, came out onto the, both of them shared the podium. And I said to people in the room, are they going to talk in unison? Like, why are they both there? And then you have these two arch sort of representatives of the establishment, the old style establishment, nothing to offer, basically signaling right from the beginning, we promise you nothing will change.
That's right.
If you are suffering, America, in any way, if your jobs aren't working, if you don't have high enough wages, if you can't send your kids to a doctor, we promise you nothing will change. But guess what? We are not Donald Trump. Our names are not Donald Trump.
That's why Stephen Colbert said that when he was done watching it, he wanted to cut himself. That's what it comes down to.
I had a similar feeling watching it. It was a painful experience. We're being led by, you know, nincompoops and charlatans, and it's just a sad time.
Well, I have some criticism for the White House staff, too. Any other president, any other White House staff would have been circulating talking points on the Hill for the past week and would have lined up as many official spokesmen as possible. And this White House just didn't do that. So what they ended up with was a president all by his lonesome and the vice president as an afterthought running to Capitol Hill to try to win hearts and minds. That should have been done a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and they should be working on flipping Democrats right now rather than trying to contain the damage among the Republicans on the Hill.
Yeah, well, it's pretty incompetent White House for sure. I mean, a lot of people have left. The staffing is low. He's never really filled out his staff because he's got these insane loyalty requirements for people, and people don't want to work for him. So,
an acquaintance of mine who works at the White House said that it's a ghost town, that either offices are empty or office doors are closed because people are in their offices writing their resumes.
Well, I have an indirect third-party source who works on maintenance of the White House decor and stuff, who said that they have a big problem because Trump insists on having a wall-to-wall carpet in his personal bathroom off his bedroom, wall-to-wall carpet in his bathroom, which means that every time he gets out of the shower, he soaks the carpet, and it's all moldy.
Oh, good.
I want to, although that's extremely interesting, I want to go to one other question for Dave Lindorf. Well, we have other questions too, but
see how good my sources are?
Do you want to reveal your sources?
No, I can't.
Okay, fine. So all day yesterday, Dave Lindorf, the talk was Donald Trump is going to declare a national emergency, use his executive authority to be able to allocate $5+ billion to build the wall. If he did that on the basis of national security, he could declare a national emergency. He has that power, that authority. Then the government could reopen. That seemed like a logical next step. Why did he not do that?
Well, I think they have to do it very carefully. I mean, I did an interview with Francis Boyle, who's a leading constitutional scholar on impeachment at University of Illinois. And he made the point that while the president could transfer some funds to fund the wall without a congressional appropriation, his ability to do that is extremely limited because he has to use some very small funds that are available that are appropriated without any purpose by Congress. And if he oversteps and uses the wrong money or pulls money from places that it was allocated for somewhere else, he's in violation of the Constitution. And, you know, it would be a huge abuse of power. Plus, if he makes the case with fraudulent claims, and there were a number of them in the little 8 minutes that he of the carefully scripted talk that he gave, they were untrue. and you know, there's lied to the American people. That was established in the Nixon impeachment articles. The first article, that lying to the American people was a constitutional crime.
Well, on that basis, every president should have been impeached.
Impeached, indeed.
Well, absolutely, but of course, there's serious offenses, lies and less, and you know, of consequence, and lies of no consequence. You know, the Nixon lies were quite substantial, and conceivably, this would be considered substantial too if he lies in order to avoid congressional appropriation rules. So, you know, I think they're being careful. And I also think they want to probably build the case more so that they've got enough public support for the wall when they do it. That, or maybe they need more pain from the shutdown to the point that people will be relieved that the shutdown gets lifted.
Dave Lindorf, we have 1 minute left. I want to ask you this. John Kiriakou made the point that Republicans are peeling away in Congress, but what you're suggesting is that this position by Trump actually still plays well with the Republican base, maybe not with some of the politicians. Do you think so?
No, I think he's losing that too, because people I know who, you know, depend on federal aid, food stamps and things, have been getting very, very upset and very worried. You know, now they're claiming that they're going to come up with the funding for the food stamps for everybody. That's a huge part of his base. You know, and if you start cutting back funding for Medicaid or, you know, any of these kind of funds that are federal money, most poor people are white and they live in not urban centers, but out in rural America and where Trump's votes come from. So there's a lot, I think that's where a lot of that peeling away is happening is, you know, and a lot of these people, you know, that say they want the wall, you know, to sort of reflexively don't even know what a Mexican looks like.
Seriously, they've never met a Mexican. We're going to have to leave it there. That was the voice of Dave Lindorf, who joined us from Philadelphia. Dave's an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to the London Review of Books, The Nation, Extra, Tarbell, and Salon.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School District are set to go on strike tomorrow after years of frustration over class sizes, salaries, and a shortage of nurses and school counselors. The district has made several offers, but the teachers' union says they don't go far enough. So barring a last-minute deal, 32,000 teachers will walk off the job tomorrow. We're joined from Los Angeles by Cecily Meyert-Cruz. She's been a teacher in the LA Unified School District for 23 years, and she's the vice president of United Teachers Los Angeles, National Education Association, the Teachers Union. Welcome to the show, Cecily.
Hi, how are y'all?
We're very happy to have you. So this is a very big deal. This is the second largest school district in America. We're talking about 600,000 students, and I saw in the LA Times today that the district is already talking about having administrators teach classes and bringing scabs in. What's going on in LA right now?
Well, a lot. A lot of legal maneuvers that are happening with our privatizer business model superintendent. They're trying to do a lot of legal tactics to get us not to strike tomorrow on some legal technicalities. So we were in court yesterday. We're going to be in court this morning, and we're also, our bargaining team is at the bargaining table this morning as well.
One thing, Cecily, is we want to help our audience over here in Washington, D.C. and the other areas not in Los Angeles. What the big issues are, what is it that's driving teachers to take this incredibly significant and obviously impactful decision? What are the big issues?
So one, respect, right? Educators have been disrespected for a long period of time, and it has been really, it's a shame that that has continued to happen. So that's one. Two, class sizes are too big. Yesterday we had parents out in front of the school district actually talking about these high class sizes, some kindergarten classes that are literally 39 students in a kindergarten class.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. A couple of chemistry classes that are over 50, where teachers are giving up their desks during the day to actually have students sitting on desks.
So would it be fair to say, Cecily, that the strike is not just for the teachers, it's for the students? You can't learn something when you're competing against 49 people in a class like a chemistry class.
Absolutely, and that goes across the board. So we put out a dynamic, broad set of package proposals, big bargaining demands, talking about things like ethnic studies, green space, ending the criminalization of youth around ending random searches, immigration, affordable housing, just really big ideas, class size, actual staffing. I'm not sure if y'all know, but 80% of our schools do not have a full-time nurse. Let that sink in.
Wow.
So basically, you know, if you don't have a nurse on Monday and your child gets hurt, they're sent back to class with an ice pack and a Band-Aid. And so essentially, educators have become and have always been the nurse, the counselor, the psychiatric social worker. Our students are different than they were 15 and 20 years ago. We need trauma-informed curriculum. There are just so many things that our students need. Full-time librarians. We need counselors. When you have a counseling ratio caseload of 1,500 to 1, how are you really servicing the needs of children? And so one of the things we know is that educators' working conditions are our students' learning conditions, and we have a duty to represent our members, but also our students, our parents, and the community at large.
We're speaking with Cecily Myart-Cruz. She has been a teacher in the LA Unified School District for 23 years, and she's the vice president of the Teachers Union, UTLA, National Education Association. I want to ask you, too, there are so many important issues here, so many important different demands. Has the district indicated to the union that they're willing to get some of these out of the way quickly? For example, you need counselors. You need guidance counselors. In many cases, you need psychological counselors. You do need full-time librarians. You need smaller class sizes. Are they willing to give on any of those just as an act of good faith?
No. We have been at the table for over 20 months. And before we even got started, the district stalled us for 57 days, not even coming to the table. We said our bargaining team was ready, willing, and able. They were ready to meet around the clock. The district said, no, I'm sorry, we don't have priorities. But then we found out that the district was having negotiations with other unions in LA Unified. So the lack of respect is appalling. Our teachers and educators know that. And enough's enough. So we feel that the time is now. We've been hopeful to resolve our differences. We've been hopeful coming to the table. We've really been hopeful. But in that hope, we also know that we're ready to go. We're ready to strike. You know, with the 98% strike authorization vote from our members, you know, the time is now.
That's exactly right. We saw what happened in West Virginia. It's not legal to strike right in West Virginia for anybody, especially public school teachers. We saw what happened in Arizona, all of these so-called red states, Republican states, but the teachers boldly did what they needed to do. They did everything before they struck. They tried to do everything to bring authority to their senses. They mobilized themselves. They had a lot of unity. And basically, because of that, they won. They won because they struck. They won in West Virginia. And when they struck and they won, they not only won a 5% pay increase for teachers, but for all state workers. Cecily, you know, we were talking about this last week, and I was just poking around and doing some research. Los Angeles spends $11,000 per student each year. The state of California spends $71,000 each year for a prison inmate. And it just made me think, like, what are the priorities of state and government authorities when you spend $71,000 to house people in jail, to put them in prison, and only $11,000 to educate them in school?
And that is exactly right. So we're choosing incarceration over education. So I'll do you one better. The stats are $10,291 that we spend per pupil and $75,560 per prisoner. And that doesn't include, obviously, court fees. And so we know the criminalization of youth. We know that, but what we're saying with those numbers, we're saying that we prioritize incarceration over education. And California is the fifth largest global economy in the world. So let that sink in. And we only spend $10,291 per pupil. We know that educators come out of their pockets every year funding their own classrooms. That hasn't changed. Our educators have done everything in their power to bolster up their classroom, but they are met with more paperwork and the daunting task of our district saying they're not good enough, being disrespected. And teachers and educators alike have taken it over the years. And what we saw in the spring with West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, we saw hope. And from hope, we have the courage and the inspiration to say enough is enough.
John, one thing that Cecily is touching on, and I think it's so important. I think it's so important for all of us here in Washington, D.C. It's so important for people around the country to recognize and understand what the issues are. What the teacher strike is signifying is in a poignant example of people taking action, being heroic, doing everything they can not to strike, but then being willing to strike if necessary. California is, the sixth largest economy in the world.
Fifth
largest economy in the world. Guess what? Childhood poverty in California is the highest rate in the country. I'm just looking at these stats right now. The highest in the country. It's not Mississippi. It's not Alabama. It's not Georgia. It's California.
Unbelievable.
So we have these teachers are fighting. This is, in a way, the old style class battle. Are they? Who's going to represent the workers, the working class communities, the poor? These teachers are representing them. Cecily, we have 45 seconds left. Go ahead. Take us out. What's your main message to people around the country?
We want your support. We need your support. This is not only happening here in Los Angeles, California. It's happening in Oakland as well. They're poised to go out on strike at the end of January or early February. We need your support. UTLA.net. Or if you want more information, we are publicschools.org. And we know that when you place students at the bottom, we know that we can't ever raise to the top. But educators are taking action like never before. So join with us. Stand with us. This is our moment. And we, the workers, have a job to do, and we're going to do it.
That was the voice of Cecily Maillart-Cruz, who joined us from Los Angeles. She's been a teacher in the LA Unified School District for 23 years, and she's vice president of the teachers union there, UTLA, National Education Association. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Newly declassified information suggests that CIA Director Gina Haspel was in charge of a secret CIA base at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, a site notorious around the world for torture of detainees. If true, the revelation shows a much deeper involvement in CIA torture than Haspel has so far admitted to. John Kiriakou, you are intimately involved in the story, not because you tortured, but because you actually went to prison for revealing the CIA torture program. Again, for our listeners, nobody from the CIA went to prison for that illegal, immoral, unethical, you can keep using other adjectives to describe that program, the program that involved tremendous barbarism and cruelty against detainees. Nobody else went to prison, But John, you went to prison because you told the truth about the torture program. But this is really a startling new news piece from the McClatchy News Service. And I don't know, startling also that it hasn't become such a big news item everywhere.
It was earth shaking when I first saw it. Now, you have to understand what happened here. What happened is you've got a transcript that's almost 22,000 pages long, right? And it's very, very boring. All it is attorneys asking the judge at Guantanamo for motions, and then the judge denying the motions, and the government objecting to the motions, and it's just mind-numbing. But then on the bottom of page 22,088, it says something that is just incredible. It says here, and this is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's attorney, one of his many attorneys, complaining to the judge that the government will not allow the defense team to identify any of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's torturers so that they can be deposed. And she's saying, to make matters worse, what Gina Haspel did when she became CIA director was she made it even more difficult to figure out who specifically was involved in the torture program. So the attorney says, and here's the quote that's so incredible. She says, quote, "So what incentive would she have," meaning Gina Haspel, "to change the classification guidance? By doing so, it makes it impossible to find out more about her involvement. It makes it impossible to find out other people who saw her there. It makes it impossible for people at Guantanamo who may have seen her when she was here as chief of base to identify her and talk about it." It's earth-shaking news that Gina Haspel was chief of base at Guantanamo, a place notorious for torture, when the torture was taking place. So the questions that I have, well, are myriad. The questions I have for Gina Haspel are, did you tell the Senate Oversight Committee that you were the chief of base at Guantanamo at the height of the torture? If you did, why wasn't that made public? Why was everything else made public? Well, it's because the CIA has been pushing back hard on Gina Haspel's background. If you go to the CIA website and you look at Gina Haspel's bio, it says that she served for 32 years, most of it overseas, and she loves hockey and movies. And that's pretty much it. So we don't know. We don't know anything about Gina Haspel. So we have to put our trust in the likes of Mark Warner and Joe Manchin and people like that on the Senate Intelligence Committee to make sure that she's the right person for the job. Well, from what we know, having leaked out, she's clearly not the right person for the job.
John Kiriakou, you have an article about this subject, and I want to encourage people to read the article. It's at Reader Supported News. The headline is "Newly Declassified Documents Shed Light on Gina Haspel's Involvement at Guantanamo." I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraphs down. You write, "Don't forget that Haspel destroyed videotaped evidence of the torture of Abu Zubaydah. Abu Zubaydah was the first al-Qaeda prisoner to be tortured." Just talk about that. Talk about what she destroyed the videotapes.
Yeah, we captured Abu Zubaydah in Faisalabad, Pakistan on the night of March 22nd, 2002. He was the first high-value target that we had captured, and we frankly didn't know what to do with him. He had been severely wounded, and so he needed intensive, long-term medical care. He was flown to a secret prison. I'm not allowed to say where this prison was, but the press has reported widely that it was in Thailand. He recovered at this secret prison. He was tortured there. He was waterboarded. He was subject to sleep deprivation. He was kept in a coffin for weeks at a time. Insects were thrown into the coffin with him because he had an irrational fear of insects. He was kept locked in a dog cage for 2 weeks.
How many times was he waterboarded?
He was waterboarded 87 times, and the waterboarding was so intense that his heart actually stopped beating, and then a Dr. Mengele-type person was nearby to get his heart going again so that they could torture him more. Well, Gina Haspel was in charge of that site, and during those torture sessions, CIA officers videotaped them. Well, the videotapes were then put into a safe in the chief of base's office. That would be Gina Haspel's office. Gina then returned from the secret site to CIA headquarters, where she was chief of staff in the CIA's counterterrorism center. Her boss at the time was the notorious Jose Rodriguez, who went on to become deputy director of the CIA for operations. The White House counsel and the Justice Department told Jose Rodriguez, "Don't destroy the tapes." First of all, just the act of destroying tapes, any tapes, is a felony violation of the Federal Records Act. The fact that these tapes were important to an ongoing criminal investigation makes it also, at the very least, felony obstruction of justice. So what he did after being specifically told not to destroy the tapes is he ordered Gina to destroy the tapes. And so Gina took them to an industrial grinder that the CIA has to do bulk grinding or grinding of things like computer hard drives. And she ground those tapes up to powder. And so no one will ever know what really happened inside that room when Abu Zubaydah was being tortured. And to make matters even worse, if I could add one more thing, Brian, in Gina Haspel's nomination hearings before the Senate Intelligence Committee, she never apologized. She never expressed any contrition whatsoever. She never said, you know what, that was the wrong thing to do. I'm sorry we did that. Those words never came out of her mouth.
She is now the CIA director.
That's right.
John Kiriakou, when you write an article like this, newly declassified documents, these are declassified, not classified, but obviously you're a former CIA officer. How do you, I mean, and you've written numerous books now about your experience and your experience in prison. What's the process?
The process is actually quite difficult. I'm contractually bound for the rest of my life to send anything I write about intelligence, defense, or foreign policy to the CIA's Publications Review Board for clearance. When you write an op-ed, that clearance is usually very quickly forthcoming. It usually takes 2, 3, maybe 4 hours. If it's particularly controversial, they may take overnight. When you write a book, it could take years to get through the process. My first book, I wrote in 9 months. It took 22 months to get it cleared. And they took out 120 pages. So with this, I sent it in to the Publications Review Board. And for the first time in the 15 years that I've been out of the CIA, I got an email saying, please call us immediately. That's never happened to me before. So I called and they said, whoa, where did you get this information? I said, it's been declassified by you. Well, what was your original source of the information? I said, McClatchy's going to publish it. They called me and they sent me a copy of it. Well, they had no idea that this had been declassified. It was obviously a mistake. They didn't mean to declassify it. It's just that when you're reading 22,000 pages of this gibberish, your eyes glaze over. And I think they just missed it. It was a human mistake.
It happens from time to
time. It happens. It does. Every couple of years, something important will be declassified when it shouldn't be. And so we went back and forth for the better part of the day. And then finally, the publications review staff said, well, it's already out there. Go ahead and publish it. And so I did.
Why is this, John Kiriakou, why is this not a huge story? I mean, I'm looking at, people can look at McClatchy. The headline, the title is, did CIA Director Gina Haspel run a black site at Guantanamo? The author is Carol Rosenberg. The date is January 8th, 2019. That's McClatchy. And John, your article is written on January 9th. People can see it at Reader Supported News. John Kiriakou, the headline is Newly Declassified Documents Shed Light on Gina Haspel's Involvement at Guantanamo. John, okay, so we have McClatchy as the original source.
Yep.
You've written an article about it. Why isn't it big news?
Yeah, it's like Carol Rosenberg and I are the only people in America who have any interest in this thing. I frankly...
Which is not true.
Which is not true. The American people are interested, but the mainstream media just simply is not covering it. And I know Carol Rosenberg. She's an outstanding journalist. An outstanding journalist. And it's not just because she talked to John Kiriakou. This article also includes quotes from Glenn Carl, who was the director of the CIA's interrogation program, and from Ali Soufan, the FBI official who was Abu Zubaydah's primary interrogator.
We're going to end in 30 seconds, but Ali Soufan, as I remember it, was the FBI person interrogating Abu Zubaydah.
Yes.
And Abu Zubaydah was talking to him.
Yes.
And then they started torturing him, even though he was cooperating and talking to Ali Soufan from the FBI.
That's right. And then Abu Zubaydah completely clammed up, and this happened twice. The CIA blew it with Abu Zubaydah. The FBI, and it's hard for me to compliment the FBI, but the FBI is really good at interrogations.
That's all the time we have. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We were talking in this segment with John Kiriakou about the revelation that Gina Haspel was at Guantanamo base commander when Guantanamo was involved in torture. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Attorneys for former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort made a critical error yesterday when they filed motions in federal court and accidentally revealed that Manafort had met in 2016 with Konstantin Kilimnik and passed him polling data. But once again, crucial details are being left out of the mainstream media narrative. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, we have a little disagreement even here amongst ourselves, and I think we're seeing the same thing in the mainstream media. CNN says this is a very big deal, and that's how they said it. Very period, big period, deal period. Others say it's not such a big deal, that all it says is that Manafort is dishonest. We all know that Manafort's dishonest, and it really doesn't advance the case at all. What we have for our listeners is Manafort's attorneys filed some paperwork with the federal court yesterday. It was unredacted, and it revealed that Manafort had met in Madrid during the campaign 2016 with Konstantin Kilimnik, who is a Russian political consultant. The FBI has said that they believe he's an intelligence officer, although they've offered up no proof that he's any kind of an intelligence officer. And that this shows that Manafort was not honest when he told the government that he had met Kilimnik twice, not three times. So why is that a big deal?
I have no idea why two versus three meetings is a big deal. I mean, to me, it sounds like a technicality and something that that Mueller may be trying to hang, use to hang Manafort, to torture him a little more. As for Kilimnik, his ties to to Russian intelligence have not been proved. The Guardian uses this crazy phrase, is believed to be linked to Russian intelligence, but we have no idea what that means or what the truth is or how much substance there is to it or what the nature of the link is. We just don't know. And he was a longtime co-worker of Manafort, so it's hardly surprising that he and Manafort would discuss all kinds of work-related matters, and that at some point he may have shown him polling data. This is data, by the way, that was commissioned apparently by the Trump administration.
Right.
So I just don't. So what is what am I missing here?
You know, it's not illegal. It's not even unethical to provide polling data that you commissioned and that you paid for to somebody that you want to share it with.
Yes, I quite agree. And there are other, but the front page article by Maggie Haberman in the Times is really a disgrace. But there's so many questions here. He asked Kilimnik to share the information with Oleg Deripaska. The Times seems, sort of hints very strongly that Deripaska is close to Putin.
Right.
But that's not at all true. In fact, Putin and Deripaska have been at odds at various times.
And isn't it true that Deripaska was suing Manafort at the time?
Yes, Manafort, in debt to Deripaska, and in order to assuage Deripaska, had offered to brief him about American political conditions. Deripaska was trying to get a visa to come to the United States, and he was hoping to use Manafort to help pave the way. But there's nothing illegal about that. And there's no indication that Deripaska is a close associate of Putin's or that Deripaska has any relationship at all to Internet Research Agency,
right,
the St. Petersburg firm, which is accused of using social media to sway voters against Clinton and in favor of Trump. This is, that all these links are just completely unestablished. This is like, when ordinary people do this, they're accused of conspiracy mongering, making all these giant leaps, without any kind of firm evidence. But the New York Times is doing it, does it every day. This is 9/11 truthers do this, JFK assassination buffs, et cetera, but you've got to be very careful and, dare I say, very conservative and how you mobilize this evidence.
Yeah, I think those are good words. I want to go back to talk again about Manafort's motivation to give polling data to this individual who the media says may be alleged to be connected in some way to Russian intelligence. I mean, he was a conscript in the Soviet Army, as were all Soviet men. So I guess that in some ways connects him to Soviet military intelligence, because that's actually about the extent of the information that we have.
He also went to a language school. Apparently, he's a very accomplished linguist. I think he speaks several languages. He learned several languages, I think one of which is Swedish.
Which would be true for almost all people in most European countries. Maybe not true for Americans about learning second languages, but certainly not unusual. Again, I want to go back to a Bloomberg piece, though, that comes from May of this year. President Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, was sued by a company tied to Russian billionaire Oleg Deripaska, who claims he was defrauded after giving $18.9 million to Manafort to invest in a Ukrainian cable television venture. The suit filed Wednesday in New York State Court by Deripaska's Surf Horizon LTD claims Manafort and his former associate, Rick Gates, that's the guy who is cooperating
that's
with
right.
the Mueller probe.
He flipped early.
Manafort and his former associate, Dick Gates, used the invested funds, quote, as their personal piggy banks, close quote, moving funds in and out, quote, without any apparent business reason, close quote, meaning money laundering and taking the money. So here we have the link, supposedly, between Manafort and this liaison to Deripaska at the very time that Deripaska was suing Manafort. Wouldn't it make sense then to assume that Paul Manafort was trying to get back in the good graces of Deripaska, his former business associate and investor who was now suing him, by saying to Deripaska, who wanted to come to the United States, hey, I'm an insider. I have knowledge about American politics. Matter of fact, I'll show you this publicly available polling data or available to the Trump administration because they commissioned it. Isn't this just a way of Manafort getting back in with Deripaska? Wouldn't that be a credible, plausible concept about why this meeting actually happened?
Yes, and in fact, we know that Manafort actually offered. I mean, Manafort was deeply in debt to Deripaska. He didn't have the money to pay him back, so he offered them, in lieu of paying him back, to brief him periodically about American political conditions. So, you know, so we know he was doing this. And so this is all on the record. So I just don't see what the big deal is. I mean, the New York Times is like, you know, is hyperventilating.
As with CNN, they were flipping out. But let me ask you then, what does any of this have to do with Donald Trump?
Or what is it? And yeah, what does it have to do with Donald Trump? And again, does it, again, prove anything about collusion, real collusion between the Russian government and the Trump campaign? Because, again, this seems to me to be one of those stories that the Manafort's lawyers made a mistake. They put it in the public record. The media seized on it. And now it's, quote, I'm looking at the headlines. This is a very big deal. Of course, everything is a very big deal. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, Maggie Haberman, the author, one of the authors of the Front Page Times article, is famous as the Democratic Party's go-to person. There was actually an email that I believe was released by WikiLeaks, in which a top DNC official says that, you know, Haberman is a reliable reporter. You know, whenever we need anything, she always obliges us. So she's very sympathetic to this Democratic Party point of view. Number one. Number two, her article hinted very gravely that the polling data might have been used by Internet Research Agency to refine its manipulation of American social media to influence voters. Now, I mean, to me, I said this is a huge stretch. It's possible, but it's like it's got to be proved very carefully, you know. And it's that the Times doesn't remotely attempt to do that.
Yeah, no, that's an important point. Yeah. Because, again, the media, like the New York Times, is telling us when Democratic Party operatives spent not $100,000, but $200,000, including in a very short amount of time, a couple weeks, right before the special election for the U.S. Senate seat in Alabama between Roy Moore and Doug Jones. They say, well, that really wasn't significant because it was a $51 million race. But here you had the presidential election. The IRA is said to have spent $100,000 over a 2-year period, not 2 weeks. and 56% of it was after the November election, and most of it wasn't about any candidate whatsoever. But that was supposedly very, very, very impactful on the outcome of the 2016 election.
Now, there's one very important point. Oleg Deripaska is the guy who, when the FBI approached him, I think it was in late 2016, and asked him what he knew about collusion between Trump and Putin. Deripaska disappointed the FBI gravely by telling them they were barking up the wrong tree, that there was no substance to these allegations of Trump-Putin collusion. So maybe all this stems from FBI pique or anger at Deripaska for somehow not telling them what they wanted to hear.
Yeah.
We're going to have to leave it there. Although this is so complicated, we're going to have to also come back to it. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
States and localities across the country are expanding health care access to their residents, despite the fact that Republicans at the federal level are still seeking to weaken or do away with the Affordable Care Act. Single-payer health care is a widely popular idea, but what is the best way to go about achieving it? We're joined from Baltimore by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's a medical doctor and the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Margaret.
Thank you for having me.
Margaret, we're seeing single-payer rollouts in places like Washington State and California and New York City, and at first glance, that seems like a great idea. Is it?
Well, I can understand why states are feeling very desperate and cities, because people in the United States are struggling to afford the health care that we need. A new report showed that 54% of people in the United States delay or avoid health care because they need it. But the reality is that the strongest healthcare system that we could have and the most efficient would be a national improved Medicare for all, because there are many barriers at the state and city level to actually creating a type of single-payer healthcare system. In fact, actually, at present, none of the states or cities could do it, a true single-payer healthcare system.
So these patchwork programs that we're seeing, we just saw one in Virginia a week or two ago. Do you think these are a good thing? Can they transition into something else, or can they transition into something at the federal level?
I think that, you know, all attempts to expand access to healthcare are a positive, but thinking that they're actually a pathway towards getting national improved Medicare for all, I think is a flawed strategy. What we're trying to avoid in the United States is creating 50 different single-payer healthcare systems, because that would be very much like our Medicaid system today.
Right.
Medicaid is, you know, is state-run, and some states have pretty good systems. Some states don't have very good systems at all, and in fact put barriers, you know, to care for people. And so a national improved Medicare for all, like our Medicare system, would be a high standard, a single high standard for every person living in the United States. It would mean that wherever anybody travels in the United States, they know they can get that same level of coverage.
Let's talk about the politics of that, too. We've got a Democratic House of Representatives now. We have a Senate that's virtually unchanged from what it was 2 years ago. What are the chances of some comprehensive legislative measure making its way through Congress in this next Congress?
Well, the reality is that the makeup of the Congress isn't as important as what the movement is creating. You know, if we create that demand that makes it so that this is something that people in power have to put forward in order to stay in power, then we're going to win no matter who's in office. Look back at, you know, the gains that we made under President Nixon because of a strong social movement at that time, and he was compelled to create the Environmental Protection Agency and OSHA, the Occupation Safety Hazards Administration. So, you know, that said, it's really up to us, and we want this to be a bipartisan-supported piece of legislation, because we don't want it to become a political football like the Affordable Care Act has become. That said, there's a lot of movement right now. You know, the Congress last year, we had the highest number of co-sponsors for single-payer legislation. They created a Medicare for All caucus. We have a pledge now from the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, that they'll hold hearings in two of the committees, which are both chaired by members of Congress who are supportive of single payer. We really need hearings in the committees of jurisdiction, which are not chaired by supporters right now. But we're seeing movement at the national level, and this is definitely the time for us to be continuing to make a very strong push.
Yeah, you know, I read these articles about Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, pushing out single payer, and Gavin Newsom making this grand announcement yesterday that this is going to be the end all for California healthcare. In Virginia, there were celebrations that it's going to be Medicare for all. And I just don't see how it's sustainable nationwide. I think you're right that we really don't have anything that's overall sustainable. It really is a patchwork like Medicaid.
Absolutely. And it's not correct for them to be calling these single-payer systems. What they're doing in Washington State is rolling out a public health insurance that will be offered to people. People can also choose the different private healthcare, you know, insurances. Some of them will be in public systems. So it's going to continue to be the exact same system that we have right now. It's just adding a new public insurance. They're not going to be able to get the savings that you could get from a single-payer system. And so we've seen states, you know, this has been going on for decades, where states have rolled out these plans. They've called them universal, guaranteed, they're going to be great, and they all run into the same problem that they're trying to operate within the current system, and so they either end up having to jettison people or they just fail, you know, over time due to the cost.
Margaret Flowers is our guest, Dr. Margaret Flowers. Dr. Flowers, you know, in many countries, healthcare is just free. I mean, meaning when you're sick or you have to go to the emergency room, you don't have to pay a bill. In our system, it's just the opposite. Medicare for all, or improved Medicare for all, is still within the market system. It's not socialized medicine. Just help explain for the audience, because people, I think, start to get confused over the way things are labeled, what the difference actually is.
All right. So single payer system refers to a healthcare system where everybody contributes into one single health insurance fund, and then everyone is covered under that fund for the healthcare that they need. There's a variety of these types of systems around the world and also within the United States. Our VA system is a purely socialized system where the Veterans Administration owns and operates the hospitals. They employ the doctors. And then we have Medicare in the United States. If you look at traditional Medicare, not the privatized Medicare Advantage scams that are out there, but our traditional Medicare that was passed in 1965, people contribute into it, and then when you turn 65, you're covered in that system. It's paid for through taxes, but the delivery side is, you know, you go to whomever is accepting that Medicare, public hospitals, public or private physician practices. And so that's what we're advocating for, as a national improved Medicare for all, would be kind of expanding that traditional Medicare and improving it to make it more comprehensive and take away the out-of-pocket costs that seniors face right now. But it would still operate with in, you know, our capitalist system. And so it's a challenge to get those for profits out of that system. A purely, you know, national health insurance like they have in the United Kingdom would be the most efficient type of system we could have.
Do you have any champion for that on Capitol Hill at all? Is there anywhere that you can go for legislative support?
Yes, we, you know, for 16 years, Congressman John Conyers was our champion in the House, and he introduced H.R. 676, which was actually based on the Physicians Working Group plan that came out of Physicians for National Health program. It's what we call our gold standard piece of legislation. Right now, Pramila Jayapal from Washington State is drafting a new piece of legislation, which we were hoping that she would introduce H.R. 676, but she wants to write her own bill, and she's not sharing that very widely. So we're pushing Congresswoman Jayapal to share the text of that legislation with us in the movement. They're asking for us to support it, but we can't support it if we don't know the details.
Yeah, right.
I mean, there's different parts of this. Like, why should healthcare be treated as a commodity at all? I mean, why?
I mean, it can't. You know, even conservatives in the United States recognize that even some of the most capitalist countries understand that healthcare is not a commodity because it's not something you have a choice about. If you become ill, if you have an injury, you need to get the care that you know that you need. If you can't get that care, then you know you may die, as many tens of thousands of people do in the United States every year because they can't get care, or you're going to have a worse outcome and then you can't work, or it's more expensive to treat you. It doesn't make any sense at all. People need health care, and actually, if we had a universal healthcare system, we would save tremendous amounts of money. You know, right now our healthcare costs are eating into our GDP. We'd save a lot of money. We'd have a lot healthier population.
And there's a lot of word games, and the word games make a big difference because it informs how consciousness is shaped. For instance, when people were arguing against even the Affordable Care Act, which is not Medicare for all, or certainly not improved Medicare for all, something very oriented towards privatization in the market, the Republicans made the argument, we don't want to have the government get between you and your doctor. And the reality that Dr. Margaret Flowers is explaining is that the American political and economic system, as it's currently organized, puts the government between people and any doctor in the millions. And as a consequence, because it's not about healthcare for people, it's about maximizing profits for investors. That's the real problem in terms of people accessing quality care with medical professionals, doctors, nurses, and others. Dr. Flowers, 45 seconds left. Take us out. How can people get involved? What should they do?
Well, you can go to our healthcare campaign, healthoverprofit.org. We run educational calls and provide tools. We need to be pressing every single member of Congress to support a real national improved Medicare for all legislation and be spreading the word in our communities so people know this is a choice that they have.
Great. That was Dr. Margaret Flowers, who joined us from Baltimore. She's a medical doctor and the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out their work at popularresistance.org. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.